House Bill 66, an act relating to workers' compensation.
Roger, I need a list of who is going to testify.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jack McClintock, Director of the Workers' Compensation Division. All this board does basically is just add another panel to the Workers' Compensation Board, the very heavy load that we're having in Anchorage from increased scheduled hearing dates. This will increase the total membership of the board on the lay member side from 8 to 10. And that means it'll be 5 labor members, 5 management members, and of course the Commissioner of Labor, or his designee, who sits as the chairman of the board. So now you'll have 11 members on the Workers' Compensation Board. Each board panel, of course, consists of the labor member, the management member, and the hearing officer, who is the commissioner's designee. So you will have now the one panel for Southeastern that covers Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. You will have the one panel for Fairbanks, and you'll have 2 panels in Anchorage. And of course, we still have the panel at large that we can draw from if any of the panel members are unavailable. As you heard me testify before, last year, probably the year before, we had gotten behind about 4 months in getting people scheduled for hearing in Anchorage. That was primarily due to a lack of hearing officers. We have sufficient number of hearing officers at this point, but we're just flat burning out our board members. We've lost 3 management members in the last 3 years. 2 this last year that were very well trained and we hated to lose them, but they just could not spend the time on the board, 94 days of scheduled hearings, and still keep up with their livelihood in the private sector. So that's why we're asking. I'll be glad to answer any questions if you can.
Representative Copeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One creation of the extra panel would be helpful in attracting back some of the people who would thus be assured of fewer meetings.
It very well may. We had a inquiry, I don't know immediately, we had one very fine person in Anchorage that is also very active in the Labor Management Ad Hoc Committee. I should have added, Labor Management Ad Hoc Committee is supportive of this bill, the WCCA, Workers' Compensation Committee of Alaska, and the board, of course. I think he might, at a later time, be interested in coming back. I don't know on this board panel, but we'd like to have him back, that's for sure.
I had just one question. How long a term would a person be appointed to in that meeting?
It would be the same terms that are provided for now, 3 years.
3 years? Mm-hmm. I think I must have read them, and I was looking at a new appointment.
Yes, and
he's a personal friend, and
right.
It was only until July 1st.
But he is completing the unexpired term of, let's see, which one is he filling? I think he's filling Jack Thompson's unfulfilled term.
That was the reason for my question, because when I looked at his particular term, I thought it expired July 1st, and I thought, gee, that's a short term.
Yeah.
But it is just filling.
Yeah, okay. Right. Because the way it rotates, they can't have the same people on the panel going off at the same time or being, you know, expired at the same time.
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Chairman. Has the number of hearings that you have per year increased?
The number of scheduled hearing days certainly have. Longer too, but you have hearings that have become much, you know, cases that are becoming much more complex, and particularly from the Supreme Court. Last injurious exposure rule is probably a good one example. And they're taking 5 to 6 or 7 hours because they pull in a lot of other employers rather than just one employer. As far as the hearings scheduled, comparing FY83 with FY84, there were about the same number of scheduled, 863, 855, but already we're up to 288 just for the first quarter of FY85, so I think we're going to see an increase. As far as, there's about the same amount of hearings actually being heard in FY83 and FY84, but we're having more hearings on compromise and releases, and we have, again, the longer number of hearing days. What we did in 1984, we provided in our budget for more hearing days, so we actually started increasing our schedule at that time. But what happens, again, we just end up board members. As far as the days scheduled, in 1984 we had 74 days scheduled for Anchorage. Totally we had 122. 1985, we've now scheduled 94 hearing days.
I have another question. Has your turnover and your burnout rate just occurred with the people in the private sector, or has it also been with people who represent labor?
No, we've not had, luckily we've not had that much turnover on our hearing officers. We just lost one recently. She went back to her same job, the hearing officer we had in Anchorage. And it's mostly at this point been in the management side, although in the past we've lost labor members too. So far, it's just the labor board members.
Representative Coker.
Thank you. I noticed we have a zero fiscal note. Could you explain the operation?
I will explain that. Again, what we basically did is in the 1985 budget, we increase the number of days and likewise increase the board fees that it would take to sit that many days. Now, that's already been built into this schedule because we planned that schedule back in 84 for 1985. With more board members, of course, we're still going to be able to schedule. The main thing we've got to do is make sure that people get to a hearing timely and there's not a backlog of people waiting to get on. So if there does become another backlog, of course, we're going to schedule the hearings. And there could be increased costs from that. But by the same token, right now we're bringing people from Ketchikan to Juneau to sit Anchorage hearings, and we're bringing them from Fairbanks down to Anchorage to hold the hearings. So we believe that we will make up some of that cost or absorb some of that cost. It also costs money to train new board members, but by the same token, with this turnover that we're having, we're training a lot more than if we got two of the social ones. So that's why it's a zero fiscal number.
I'd like to add to the record that Representative Boucher has joined us.
Yeah, my apologies for being late.
This is the only committee of referral on this particular bill, so I guess we should be as thorough as possible since it goes to Rules next for scheduling on the floor. My observations are just that with the zero fiscal note, it'll just increase the people to draw from so that the workload spread out a little more.
Basically, we're just spreading the workload among our lay board members for about the same amount of hearings so that we don't lose them.
Representative Copeland.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. It doesn't seem to be a controversial measure and seems actually to suit the public interest. If there is no opposition, I'd like to move that we pass out House Bill 66 with individual recommendations.
Are there any objections or did anyone else wish to testify on this bill? So moved. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
since the next bill had three referrals.
Just working.
Okay, the next bill we'll be discussing is House Bill 62, an act relating to the payment of prevailing wages and the payment of overtime on the public construction contracts. First person to testify is Robert Bocolis.
Bocolis.
Bocolis. Senior Director of Labor Standards and Safety Division in the Department of Labor.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Bocolis. I'm the Director of Labor Standards and Safety for the State of Alaska Department of Labor. As a preliminary matter, Mr. Chairman, just a short time ago, we determined that we inadvertently omitted a section in Section 1 of the bill. Would propose to amend that at this time. I don't have a written proposed amendment, Mr. Chairman, but I will refer you to the section that we're talking about. Beginning at line 10, section 1 of the bill, as originally submitted, specifically section 36.05.15, overtime requirements, it presently reads, A, notwithstanding the provisions of AS 23.10.060, 17 and 18, we'd like to amend it to read AS 23.10.0601, 17 and 18.
I'd like to move to insert in line 11 between AS 23.10.060 and parens 17, parens 1. Is that correct?
Line 12.
Yes, it's line 12.
Line 12. Not
line 12.
Unanimous consent.
Is there any objection? Okay. So amended.
Bill becomes House Bill number 62.
Okay. Can you substitute for House Bill?
No, it's just amended
House
so
bill?
Far.
Yeah. House Bill 62 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 62, in addition to making a number of statutory housekeeping changes, also establishes or clarifies several important points concerning wages and hours of work on public construction projects. Section 1 provides a system of overtime compensation consistent with the Federal Labor Bacon Act, after which our law was modeled. Since the state does not have comparable enabling legislation, at the present time we have to turn to AS 2310 for an authority. While AS 2310-060 provides for overtime on the 8-hour-a-day, 40-hour-week basis, this provision does not apply to employees with fewer than 4 regular employees. Under the Federal Davis-Bacon Act, all employees, regardless of how many or how little, are covered in terms of the time and a half compensation for any hours over 8 hours or 40 hours in the week. under our current law that we have to rely upon because we don't have the enabling legislation, any employer that has less than four employees, of course, is exempt from paying overtime. This poses a number of problems. First of all, it puts the employees on an unequal footing with other employees in the state in terms of overtime compensation. Also, it puts the contractor that bids on public construction projects as a competitive disadvantage, because if an employer has only, say, three employees, he can bid at a lower labor cost than an employer that has more than four employees. So it's possible that an employer that has three employees would be able to work those employees for a period of 15 hours a day without having to be concerned about paying time and a half for all overtime. Obviously, this puts many of the contractors that have more employees at a competitive disadvantage. Well, Section 2, excuse me, also this particular section provides that this section will be considered included in all contracts, whether or not the contracting agency includes it in the contract. It's my understanding that there is some opposition to this particular provision being included in this particular bill. We would strongly endorse this remaining in the bill for the reason that if a contracting agency inadvertently excludes that provision in the bill, then an employer would be able to take the position that, so if it's not included in the bill, then I don't have to pay the prevailing wage rate or overtime. This can be used a number of ways, and I'll give you a couple scenarios. Say, for example, a contracting officer in a small community like a village or a borough or what have you decides that he wants to get the most out of his money. He might get a hold of a friend of his who is also a contractor and indicate, I'm going to intentionally leave this provision out of the contract and you bid on that project. That way I can get more money for my dollar. For example, he may have received a contract for a parking area and a couple flagpoles and some lighting. By not having to pay the prevailing wage rate, he would be able to stretch that dollar to perhaps provide for three flagpoles and more lighting, that sort of thing. Also, another problem that we envision under this type of situation would be if an unscrupulous contracting officer and an unscrupulous contractor decided that they would intentionally leave this provision out of a contract and then perhaps entertain a kickback type situation. So we feel that this is necessary to have this provision in here in case of a contracting agency inadvertently leaving it out. We also find that in a lot of cases, some of the smaller communities that receive grants are totally unaware of the requirements to include this type of language in the contract through mistake or total ignorance. If it isn't included in there, then also the employer could take the position that since it isn't included, then he's not responsible for paying the prevailing wage rates. Okay, Section 6 provides that even if the public construction contract does not set out the conditions as set forth in AS 3605070, that all of the conditions are included in the contract. That's what I just discussed, which is also included in Section 6 as well as Section 3. Section 8 authorizes the Department of Labor to bar persons who have failed to comply with the overtime and prevailing wage requirements of the chapter from being awarded public construction contracts up to 3 years. These persons, of course, would be entitled to the full protection of the Administrative Procedure Act. Section 3 and 9 of the bill authorizes the Attorney General to seek injunctive relief and civil penalties in the Superior Court for failure to comply with AS 3605. Under existing AS 3605060, violation of the chapter is a misdemeanor, but this enforcement mechanism has not been as effective because of the nature of the penalty and the high standard of proof required
in criminal cases. To explain that a little bit further, it provides for a misdemeanor. In order for us to prosecute a contractor, we have to go to the district attorney's office, file a complaint. And that's generally not one of the most burning issues of our time with a district attorney, so a lot of times we get put on the back burner. Under the proposed bill, once we make a determination that a contractor is in violation of the law, we can then seek the assistance of the Attorney General's office and proceed accordingly. That's about all I have. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Chairman, I had just one question. Public contracts are, and people bidding on those are obligated to pay the Davis-Bacon, Little Davis-Bacon wage scale.
Yes, ma'am.
Has been, in your experience, have there been violations of those wage provisions not being paid?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you see this as a way to enforce or to tighten up some of that?
Yes, I do.
Representative Collins.
I have two questions. One of them, you indicated that because of the way things currently are, and one of the needs for this bill is the fact that some employers are put at a disadvantage in terms of bidding for some of the contracts. Do you have any idea what percentage of the contractors are adversely, currently being adversely affected?
No, I don't have that information at this time.
Do you have any perception if it's 1%, 10%, 80%?
I really could future, yes, at this point. I do know that we've had that problem. I can give you an example of the type of problem we're dealing with. For example, if you have an unincorporated business, such as a sole proprietorship or a partnership, and generally that's a husband and wife or father and son operation, they can essentially bid on a contract knowing that they cannot be counted as employees. So it's, in essence, they could hire three additional employees, making their five, and still not have to pay them overtime because of the exemption. What this bill does, it cures that problem. In other words, it puts all of the employers on an equal footing in terms of competitive bidding. In other words, anybody that bids on a public construction project would be required to pay time and a half to all employees, regardless of the number. We feel that would cure a lot of the problems that we have.
A couple of other questions, if I may. I guess what I'm looking at is in terms of how it would affect, say, the cost of public projects. And I guess I'm saying that with this kind of thing, it reduces the flexibility in terms of bidding and perhaps getting some of those projects done at a lower cost. I also have a concern that being given sort of the opportunity to do time and a half, or people are going to do time and a half rather than getting the projects done in a timely fashion. And how do you see that?
Of course, the purpose of the Overtime Act traditionally has been to penalize the employer, not the employee. The purpose is to allow more people to be left to work. That was where it evolved many, many years ago. This also, by creating a situation where the employer has to put more people on the job to get the job done, it, of course, stimulates the economy. More importantly, it also protects the very health and well-being of the employee. Because the more hours you work, the more you get fatigued, and it could have some impact on a person's potential to become injured as a result of being overly fatigued or tired or ill or whatever. As far as what impact this would have, on a lower cost to government, I have no way of knowing that. I wouldn't want to venture a guess.
Would you expect that that would have a tendency to, say, make no difference in terms of the cost of public construction, or have a tendency to potential to increase it? That's my concern. And
would you repeat that question again?
So you said you don't have any idea what it would be, and I'm saying you have it just some kind of flavor. What this is saying to me is that this guarantees that public, that given the option, that public construction will be done at the highest cost. So maybe that's an incorrect perception, but that's what I see in terms of looking at the bill and its effects. And it would seem to me that it essentially guarantees that the public work will be done at a higher rate. And I'm asking what your perception is of that. Is that a potential for that happening with this bill?
I don't know how to answer that. Of course, we model our act after the Federal Davis-Bacon Act, which requires that time and a half be paid on all classifications working on a public works project. Of course, the prevailing wage rates are established by an annual survey conducted by the Department of Labor. That's based on the majority penetration of each job classification for laborers, mechanics, and surveyors. Of course, when you pay time and a half, and you don't have to pay straight time, your costs are going to increase. But again, it puts more people to work, obviously. It protects the safety and the health of the employees. And I know it's required under the Federal Davis-Bacon Act and required in most of the other states in the nation as well.
At this time, I'd like to add for the record that Representative Davis joined us some time ago, and as an oversight, I forgot to mention it. Representative Hammer?
Yeah, well, I have one more question. We're referring to the Federal Davis-Bacon. Are you referring to that? How do the state Davis-Bacon wages compare to Federal Davis-Bacon?
They're almost identical.
Are they almost
identical? In fact, I believe they are identical this time. I might add something that we conduct an annual survey for preventing wages, as I mentioned previously. We use on-site consultation with employers. This is an ongoing process. We also use Dodge reports, which include projects in the state of Alaska that also include non-union as well as union contractors. And this particular survey has been so well received by the Federal Department of Labor that they have adopted our procedure and have adopted our wage survey. So I don't know the exact date, but as I recall, it was a couple months ago or so. So the Federal Davis-Bacon rates are identical in most cases to ours. The only exception would be the residential construction, which would be somewhat different. But that's under the HUD arm of the U.S. Department.
Representative Boucher.
Obviously, you've got some examples in mind. You specifically mentioned Alaska. You were giving examples, the parking lot, et cetera. If you could, are there specific examples that brought this about, or is it just a housekeeping measure? Or is it, in other words, obviously, you're bringing it here. Reason.
Well, this bill
behind it other than the equity, that's obvious.
Well, this bill pretty much codifies existing interpretations. We have had these problems that I spoke to earlier. Mm-hmm. For example, we had a bridge job, I can't tell you exactly where it was, where the contracting agency contracted the construction of the bridge out. It was later determined that the bridge was defective, and they had to hire an additional contractor to come in and do the job. That type of situation is an example of some of the problems that we run into in particular.
You mentioned a mom and pop operation, father and son. Those were six members of a family.
Six members?
All the same family in the same company. Does that mean you could put nine on?
Yes, I believe it would, sir.
You've got a big family, you could have a construction company, you know, you move up about 10 or 15.
Conversely, a corporation has to count all of their agents, officers, and so forth as employees. Mm-hmm. But a partnership or a sole proprietorship, they don't have to count themselves as employees.
Okay. A partnership, right? So you could have five or six as a partnership.
That's a possibility, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative
Copeland. Thank you. In response to Representative Boucher's question, I remember one case years ago when there was a much more lenient interpretation of Davis-Bacon, I think maybe that's when you were Lieutenant Governor, or before that, it was the Inanna Canyon Survey, the original. Because of the term interpretation, there was an outfit in New Orleans that got the survey and the design portion of the survey, and they worked on photogrammetry and hired graduate students at Louisiana State. Did a wonderful job. The only problem was they didn't realize that what they were doing the photography on was snow-covered ground, and some of the fill areas were, some of the cut areas were 15 feet in the air, you know, where there was some, where the survey said they should cut, and that was completely, it didn't have much to do with the competent, with a competent engineering outfit, but because of the quirk in the law at that time that permitted them on the basis of not prevailing wage but other matters to get the bid, you had people who didn't really realize that they were looking at snow and thinking it was ground. But that doesn't happen too frequently, but that was a famous case.
Thank you very much. Thank you. There are no further questions. Next person who wishes to testify is Risha King with the Associated General Contractors.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Risha King with Associated General Contractors, and we basically are supporting what the department is trying to do, except for two sections. I distributed to staff, I think it was yesterday, a paper that our attorney sent down outlining two sections. One is on page 1, line 21. Provisions of this section are considered included in all contracts for public construction in the state. And the same language is on page 3, line 26. We would like to see that language taken out of the bill. If a community does, in fact, inadvertently leave it out of their contract, why should the contractor be responsible for their error? Basically, and it puts more of a burden and a risk on the contractor. We've got enough of them as it is right now. So if you have any questions, that's basically it.
Chairman, I don't know if I'm in order here, but when I hear opposing views, I like to hear the response of the department to that, if I may, although he's not a witness now. Am I in order?
Okay, if there are no objections, would you mind coming back up to the table and we could maybe... Maybe you could both be up there. And
There's no sense in that. Are there any other witnesses here that are going to be... I'm not the expert in this piece.
Well, under the way the bill's written at this time, this precludes an employer from avoiding compliance with the chapter when the government agency inadvertently excludes that language from the contract. It's our position that both the contracting agency and the contractor should be equally responsible. I don't think that ignorance of the law is any excuse. I believe that if the contracting agency was held responsible because of the fact that they forgot to include that in the contract and were subject to having to pay the difference between the deficiency and the prevailing wage rate, and that actually received, then that would not only increase the cost of government, but it would also take and directly affect the employees who should have been receiving those particular wages. I don't see how the contractor would be at a disadvantage by including this type of language. It's already included in Title 23-10060, and also in this chapter under 36-10080. So it's already included in the chapter itself anyhow. But we feel that both the employer and the contracting agency should be equally and jointly responsible, not be able to have the advantage of avoiding their obligations under the law or the intent of this particular legislation.
Thank you. Would you like to respond to that?
Yeah.
Well, that's in paragraph 2 of our statement. The existing law requires that the advertised specification for public construction include various provisions of Title 36, 05, 07, 05. So they're supposed to do it,
If they don't do it, why should we be responsible? That's the point. Should this section are considered included in all contracts? Presumption that they include it in there versus actually put it in there. They've got boilerplate contract clauses that are just filling the blanks, basically, so it's not all that difficult for them to put them in there.
But, excuse me, go ahead, would you like to...
Mr. Chairman. Using the example that I made earlier of the contracting officer in a small community or a village or an unincorporated borough may not realize that that's necessary. May know nothing about public contracts. And so, through no fault of his own, he fails to put that in. Well, I feel that that's an inequity because then he would be required to pay if the Department of Labor enforced against the contractor who wasn't paying the prevailing wage rate. The contractor would really gain a benefit from it, but the poor contracting agency would suffer as a result of that. And again, that would increase the cost of government.
Thank you.
I'd like to have a committee discussion. I mean, we'll get to the nitty gritty of this.
We have a question here from Representative Copeland.
Excuse me.
Oh, no, thank you. I think this illustrates there aren't always just two sides to the question. I can imagine that we might, if we do this, we'll have the municipal league in here screaming for our scouts.
Okay. Ms. King, would you like to respond now?
Well, I don't think that the small villages are quite as naive as he would like. Let us think they are. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs has all sorts of brochures and things that they send out to the community on such things. If, in fact, the community does put a project out for competitive bidding, they have the forms available. So it's not really, they're not that bound as they used to be. Granted, 5-10 years ago, their naivety level was extremely high. They're getting very sophisticated computers that are popular out in the villages now, this sort of thing. So it's not like they're some poor guy sitting in his own house or at the kitchen table trying to do a public construction project in ENIAC or Lindo or whatever.
No, but there are occasional turnovers and things like that where someone might not be aware of all the provisions, and when they look it up, if it's not included in the law, it might be left out. In that case, then, the responsibility is on the contracting agent rather than on the contractor.
Mr. Chairman, the documents and brochures that Reese is talking about have most recently been sent out to the various communities. This is something that hasn't happened a crucial period of time ago. It's something that's just been accomplished. From the Department of Labor standpoint, we've had experience in enforcing the particular laws that we're talking about here today. And I can assure you that there's a lot of communities, including communities in such as the Madawaska Valley, that are totally unaware a lot of times of the laws, and even some of the contractors. So it's not like everybody is fully aware of the law.
The information and brochures that you talked about sending out, does it include recommendations that this be included in the contracts?
Yes. This occurs a lot, Mr. Chairman, through pass-through grants, for example. That's where a lot of the problems come about. And again, contrary to belief, a lot of these people in the smaller communities, I'm not just referring to rural areas, I'm talking about areas like Palmer and Wasilla and some of those, are just totally unaware of what's required under the law until it's brought to their attention. A lot of times, both the contractor and the contracting agency will be unaware that they're violating the law, and after the project's completed, then it comes to our attention and we end up enforcing retroactively against both parties. So it isn't something that's standing out there like a sore thumb, so to speak.
Mr. Chairman, can I say one thing on that?
Would you state for the record, please?
I'm in Plate, Department of Labor. I just like to clarify one thing, and that is that the Department of Labor's concern is we're not defending the contracting agency. Our concern is that the worker receive his wages. And without this provision, he can get caught up in between a battle between the state and the contracting agency. Meanwhile, this worker is laying out here and hasn't been paid. The contractor does have recourse to the court system if there's a problem between his contract with the contracting agency, and we view that as that avenue for recourse when if there has been an omission in the contract that way. And we're concerned to get that worker his wages, but not getting caught up in a battle over contract provision. And that's our primary interest.
Thank you. Is there any data?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there other people who can testify on this?
Is there anyone else who should testify, Representative Hamlin?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm trying to put these pieces together to make sure that I understand what you're saying. And my experience with any of this has been as a member of a school board, and I recognize that when we were using state monies, any time that state monies, which was, I guess, just about all the time, that we had to comply with the Davis-Bacon wage scale. It took me a while to get that all straight. Well, now looking at this, it would be my assumption that then if that school district was putting something out for bid, that this would have to be spelled out pretty clearly by the district, so that someone bidding on that would know that he would have to pay Davis-Bacon, would know that he'd have to pay time and a half, and that would certainly have to be figured into his bid proposal. Now, if the school district neglected to put into this section or eliminated this one little section here and inadvertently did not indicate that time and a half would have to be paid in the contract to bid using the Davis-Bacon wage scale but not knowing that he had to pay time and a half, you're saying that then the contractor would be the one responsible, even though if it wasn't written, the school district hadn't written it clearly. Is that kind of what the argument kind of, in those terms, would it boil down to that?
Prepare your bid package based on the information that appears in the documents they give you. And if it doesn't say prevailing wage and time and a half and all that, your figures would be different
really
than somebody else that...
if you didn't know that you had to pay time.
You don't know what the rules of the game are. And that's the reason we don't think it should be just assumed that it's in there by this section here. There's the statute presently says that they're supposed to put it in there. And let's have some enforcement to say of what's already on the books instead of shifting some of the burden over to the contractor or the community not doing their business.
We oppose requiring a contractor to place the language in a contract. We have no objection to that whatsoever. But what we object to, as proposed by RESA, is that the contractor be completely exempt from any liability, and more importantly, that the employees would suffer because of that as a result of the inadvertence of the contracting agency to put that in the contract.
Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned earlier that this what's contained in this bill is actually what's practice and what's also in administrative regulations already. So do you have any kind of sense on how much, what kind of non-compliance is taking place right now, that and the reason why in this bill has been introduced? I mean, as far as time and a half, I think most workers, they know that they should be getting time and a half, so they're going to be complaining. So I can't see that, you know, someone saying, gee, I didn't know I wasn't getting time and a half on this job. I'd be scratching my head the first day I worked 9 hours and didn't get paid time and a half. But and that's sort of an aside, I suppose. But the concern I have is you're saying that there's non-compliance going on there right now. I'm just curious just how much.
I don't have the figures with me, Representative.
I'm talking about generalities here.
We have quite a bit of activity in that regard. I would hate to venture a guess as to how much and what dollar figure to attach to that, but I wouldn't be at all opposed to getting that information. I'd be happy to do that. I can give you a pretty good idea of how much we'll probably have had based on our enforcement and the amount of wages that we've recovered on prevailing wage deficiencies.
Representative Copeland.
Yeah, I can see that the argument being over actually points of contact, well, I can understand why it's been referred to judiciary where all the lawyers are.
That was one thing I was going to point out, is that this is referred to judiciary after us, so the lawyers will have a chance to haggle over it. Is there anything else any of you would like to offer? Representative Davis?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, are you going to entertain a motion to move the bill? Or?
I would rather hold it over and do a little more background research on it. If that's
maybe, sorry, Mr. Chairman, perhaps those members who have some desire for a particular kind of information might make their desire known at the time.
I'd like to see the same sort of thing that Representative Davis asked for, as far as what sort of claims they've handled.
Would you be willing to provide that information to us, and when would it be available?
Probably in just a few days.
Okay.
I'll try to compile that data as soon as possible and get it to you today.
Okay. My intention then is to hold the bill over until next week, and we'll bring it up at the committee meeting then. Thank you very much. Appreciate your taking the time today. For information of the committee, what I'd like to propose during our discussions and talks with different witnesses, if you go through the chair to ask a question, so long as you're asking follow-up questions and someone else hasn't been identified by the chair, I would just say that that's fine. You don't have to go through the chair on every question. Representative Copeland.
Yes, additional information. I would like statements on the municipal agency.
We'd like a statement from the municipal league. On this, would you?
On the alternative proposal.
Well, if there were no objections, that's all we have scheduled for today, and I'll adjourn the meeting.
Thank you.